our churches need to be unsafe for perpetrators.
That's right.
That's what we're aiming for here. Like,
yeah.
And that's the problem, is we've sort of been like, oh, we've been focusing on like, how do we listen well? How do we receive? How do we, and actually the question needs to be, how do we make this so clear to potential abusers and perpetrators that not only will you not be safe here, you're going to be exposed here, you're going to be identified here, and then you're going to be like kicked out of here, because we have a zero tolerance for abuse and abusive cultures in this church. And so I think that's where this, like, I literally think these are the signs of grooming, like this isolation, this like your special, but don't tell anybody we have this relationship. This like segregation, this isolation, this emotional manipulation, this spiritual spiritualization of harmful behavior. So whatever harmful effects it takes, often this is what makes clergy sexual abuse so destructive. So Brave Global is one of the initiatives that I'm probably most proud of. So it took me.
We connected, actually. You came to the church I was working at.
That's the first Brave in Toronto.
Yeah, Canada. That's right.
And Brave seeks to empower girls before they're trafficked. And there's a lot of statistics that pointed us in the right direction to identify vulnerable girls and to try to get to them first.
And so much of Brave is really cool, actually. It's really exciting. I think the way that you wrap around the girls who are involved and take seriously the risks of vulnerable girls, but also do so much to empower them. I think that word empowerment comes up over and over again, and it needs to, and it should, and it does.
Yeah, so braveglobal.org is where you want to go for the main. There's also braveglobal.ca, which is the Canadian Brave site. So if you're Canadian, you want to donate to Brave this Christmas, that would be so wonderful for us to fulfill our mission and our mandate, which is to empower and mobilize communities to then be a solution to the problem of human trafficking and exploitation. So we want to prevent exploitation from happening. It is, I don't even know how to describe it to you, but the first Brave event I went to live, I felt like this big cosmic key turned in a door and it opened. And it was a door that had been locked forever. And I just feel like there's a generation that wants to get out of this onslaught, this like sort of perpetual cycle of servitude, and they're leaving, and it's beautiful to watch. So let my people go. And if we need you to help us continue that work, so braveglobal.org or braveglobal.ca. Either way, if you would consider gifting that organization in order for them to continue their great work, that'd be awesome. Okay, welcome everybody back. If you've come back.
Hello. Yeah.
These are some pretty heavy topics, and we just want to recognize that. Usually we laugh a little bit more, but.
You know, sometimes people listen to podcasts at like 1.5 speed. Yeah. Listen to these at like 0.5 speed. That's like, just take it slow.
Right. And, but welcome back to the Right Side Up podcast. And we are in a season, if you're not tracking with us on all the things I can't live with about clergy sexual abuse. Episode one was around fake confessions, and we spent some time debunking them. And it was a little cathartic, actually, for me personally, just to finally do what I felt needs to be done for a long, long time, and no one's done yet. So I just feel like, yay. We've been joined by Charlotte, and she's back for episode two. She comes with a wealth of wisdom all the way across the pond in the UK. So we've got a Canadian and UK.
It's the UK Alliance right now.
UK Alliance. That's right. Well, I'm, you know, technically, what am I, loyal to the throne or some ridiculous thing like that?
Me and Charlotte are not. Don't worry.
My family has this ongoing. My kids are all very like, we're part of the Commonwealth. And I'm like, down with the, you know, so we always have this like family debate. But anyway, this episode, we want to talk about grooming, the difference between abuse and an affair. Grooming and consent. And so there's a lot in this. And again, trigger warning. So if you are someone who has been abused or close to somebody who's been abused, the content of these conversations are going to be triggering. So don't worry. Don't feel bad. Feel free not to listen by all means. And also feel free to pause and take your time and just care for yourself, because these things are maybe even they're not even that hard to listen to, but they do something inside of you that might be difficult. So just be aware of that. We're aware of that. We just think the speaking out is important, and we don't want to neglect that opportunity that we have to just keep moving into more and more truth. So take care of yourself, please. Welcome back, Charlotte. Thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So this is one of the things I can't live with, which is this constant framing of sexual abuse by clergy as affairs.
Yeah.
I think you feel the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it belies it. Like, we don't recognize what everybody says outside of the church about abuse and violence and kind of intimate partner violence and all of those things, which is, these things generally are a pattern. Mm-hmm. This isn't that we don't believe people have affairs. Grown people fall in love with people and do so in awkward situations all the time. That is not what this is. And we need to start being clear that that is not what this is. If you are a member of clergy and somebody is under your care, that's not just a normal affair. And we need to start being straight about it, I think.
Yeah, I feel like that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like that's true for clergy, need to be reminded, and you would hope they would be reminded more often that this position that you hold comes with responsibilities. And that's kind of where we've really fallen behind, I think, other professions that have a similar power. So if you're a counselor, you're a therapist, or you're a medical doctor, or any sort of position that has kind of this power over somebody, and you have a so-called affair with a patient, you know, the medical board's like, bye-bye. They instantly, they're like, that's not an affair. That is something totally different. And so I think the church just needs to catch up to the power dynamics that are at play, the position that you hold and the power that it wields, and that what you think, even maybe you think, oh, this is an affair, it is not. And here are some of the reasons why.
Yeah. And hopefully some of the things we can, you know, we can do things about it. Like you say, other professions have policies for these things. Like, why? If it is a genuine affair, if it's a genuine love connection, it's just in an awkward situation, we can have a policy for dealing with that. That is not what's happening here.
Yeah, I wonder too. So it just, like, right out front, like an affair. So one of the big differences, so people are like, well, what's the difference? Well, here, just really quickly, here's a difference. An affair is a consenting sexual relationship between two adults with the same power differential. Yeah. A clergy sexual abuse situation is a sexual violation of a relationship that includes a power over.
Yeah.
So in essence, when a congregant is, even if the congregant is going like, no, I really want this, like, you know, this is what I want, because of the power differentiation between the pastor who wields authority over that person, both spiritually, emotionally, even sometimes, a lot of times job related, a lot of people work for the church. It actually erases the ability of that person to genuinely consent. And this isn't just, I'm not making this up. This is the law. Like, this is how the law defines. The law no longer recognizes people who are in that kind of power in indifference as being able to consent.
That's right. Yeah.
So a consensual relationship is not even possible when it's somebody you have power over in enough of a power differential.
Yeah, that's it. There are some people who cannot consent. And we recognize that. And we've only encountered that when we think about, say, minors, you know, people who are under the age of consent, and we recognize that they cannot consent. It doesn't matter whether they want to sleep with their teacher or not. Their yes doesn't count because of that power differential. And the same with vulnerable adults. Now, the thing about a church that we have to keep remembering is any of us can be vulnerable adults at any point. Now, there is a legal definition of a vulnerable adult, but we are all people who put ourselves under the care of someone when we're in a church structure. And so we're all more vulnerable than that person at the top, you know? So we understand it with minors. We need to start understanding it with our bigger institutions. Some people can't consent. So it doesn't matter whether they say yes. That shouldn't be a question when we debate whether abuse happened. Did they say yes or not? Doesn't really matter. It's the actions of the perpetrator that matter.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting how we also don't struggle with like a counselor and somebody in therapy and go like, no, that obviously is somebody taking advantage of that emotional trust. We don't even think twice about a doctor with a patient sexually assaulting them in their office. Like we're like, dude, that's like such a violation of like this trusting relationship that you have. And then when it comes to clergies, we're like, well, everybody sins, you know, people have affair. Like I was like, what? Like the
fallen short of the glory of God. And then, you know, like, well, that's just in our nature to sin. Like, well, no,
there is this position of power and trust that you have that then makes consent a non thing. Like that person cannot consent to this violation of this trust that is literally abusive by its So that's one thing. So that's why it's different, guys. That's not just like, it's really bad because he's a pastor and he shouldn't have sex with a congregant. That's not it. Yeah. It's that the power differential is so unique and emotionally potentially power, like manipulative and spiritually abusive, that this is an abusive position and there's no other way around it. So that's what it is. What I think is really interesting is not only is that true, that there's this lack of consent because vulnerable people can't consent. But what I feel is really a very clear pattern in the clergy sexual abuse cases that I know about and I've followed and read and just even heard about my own life is this idea of grooming. And this is also really important. Again, back to our episode one, we're not going to want to believe this is true, but trust me when I tell you it's true. And Charlotte, you just mentioned this pattern that often these so-called affairs have in the elements, when we hear the story, these elements of grooming, which is an intentional, whether or not someone really means like, is like, I'm going to go groom somebody, whether or not that it's on that level, but there is a pattern and there is a way that people keep abusing people under their power. And that's called grooming. So it's manipulation, it's persuasion, it's spiritual abuse. It are all these different angles of how people, it's identifying in this setting, it's identifying women or girls who have vulnerabilities that can be exploited. You know, there's all of these different patterns of grooming that actually land in the sexual abuse category.
And there's quite a few of them as well that we, because we, and again, rightly want to think the best of people. I don't want us to get to a point where at church we don't think the best of people. But it does mean that sometimes we see things that we know are off, but we brush them aside because of the other things that are happening. You know, so the phrases that you hear when we then start talking about whether somebody was grooming someone, people will say, well, I've never seen that sort of behavior. Or, well, yeah, I did see that they were mainly meeting with young women, but, you know, they're so good at thinking about those issues. So I didn't think, like, we brush them off because of the other actions that this person is doing that make us trust them.
Yeah.
An abuser isn't an abuser all the time. We wouldn't have an abuser at the front of our church. If they were just berating people, if abuse looked like swearing, hitting people, being violent, being obnoxious, they would never get to the front. So an abuser isn't abusing all the time, but they are creating a narrative about themselves and a persona that allows them in other spaces to be abusive.
And unfortunately, that will look much like someone who is acting with integrity. And I think that's it's interesting me thinking of my role as a pastor here. I do want people to trust me. I do want people to be able to share things with me. I do want to be someone that they can come to with things that are, and they do. And it's an incredible privilege when people share things with me that they might not be comfortable sharing elsewhere. I do want to show people who Jesus is. I do want them to know that they are loved and brilliant and created good. And all of these things are so important to me. But at the same, and I think we need to recognize that, this is two sides of the same coin. And often, people who are abusive are actually, we hear this all the time. Like, well, he doesn't seem like the type. And my question was, what do you think an abuser looks like? Like, do you think that they, again, like, you know, a wife beater with stains and, you know, constantly swearing? Yeah, that person may well be abusive, absolutely. But the number of times that women especially have come forward and people go, oh, but it doesn't seem like the type, right? But that's exactly the type, because that's who gets away with this stuff.
Yeah. So yeah. I do this preach. I did it with my friend Tanis. So I spent years and years with women, getting women out of sexual exploitation. And, you know, 110% of the women in sexual exploitation were abused. I mean, yeah, this is sort of where that goes. Mm. And there's so many, you know, the grooming process and just actually the expertise of male abusers who groom, it's amazing to me. Like, I'm just like, wow, like, this is a practice. Like, the people have learned how to spot vulnerabilities, to manipulate those vulnerabilities in order to extract what they want, in whatever form that is. And I remember I did this, this preach for Brave, where I talk about my friend who we were whitewater rafting, and we all were supposed to, at this point, we're all supposed to jump out of the raft and like swim like crazy to the shore so we can jump off this cliff into the water. It was really fun. And she jumped off with everyone. But when we got to the shore, she wasn't there. And we were like, where'd she go? It's my friend Denise. And we saw her floating towards the rapids. She had forgotten she had like her jacket, her plastic jacket on. So when she jumped in the water, she had a life jacket on, but her jacket filled with water. So she couldn't even lift her arms, let alone swim. Uh-huh. And I was like, that's exactly what oppression's like, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, or vulnerabilities are like, is they get, they're a part of you. And so what is normal and natural for somebody, you can't do because you're like weighed down by this kind of oppression. So then I explained that this really strong guy with a kayak comes out and like rescues her. So she tells a story going like, it really wasn't that bad. And he puts out the kayak paddle and says like, hang on. And so all she has to do is try to lift up her hands and hang on to this paddle. And then he's like, I got you. And he tows her back to shore. And so I am up there and I'm saying like, hang on, I've got this paddle. And I'm just like, you know, when help is offered, you just hang, what are you going to do? Hang on. And then Tanis, my friend who's been sexually exploited her whole life, she was free for many years. She would stand up in the congregation with another paddle. And mm-hmm. she would say, if only it was that easy. And then everyone would be like, what's happening right now? And she would march up to the front with this other paddle. And she would say, that's exactly what happened to me. I was drowning and somebody offered me a paddle, except instead of that paddle saving me, it destroyed me.
Yeah.
And then it becomes, okay, yeah, because what we want it to be black and white, we want it to be super clear, but actually grooming looks like help. Yeah. And this is one of the things that I think we need to keep talking, like, the process of grooming a vulnerable person looks like and feels like salvation to that vulnerable person. It's somebody often who sees you for the first time. It's someone with power who is affirming you for the first time. It's someone who's like, I see potential in you. It's someone who's kind of building up. It's someone who you can tell your secrets to, who won't judge you. You know, it's like all of these things that feel like you're being saved. And then somehow in the process of you going like, this is amazing, I feel like this person, no one understands me like him. I've never connected like this before. This, no one ever has affirmed me like this before. This paddle then turns into some sexual weird relationship that then you all of a sudden feel shame and fear. And now you're under control and it twists it into this like death.
Yeah.
That's what grooming is it's this pretending to offer help sensing the vulnerabilities of somebody, pretending to offer help for it, but then using that very thing, which looks like something good and salvation, to actually be self-serving for the groomer and to be destructive and, you know, I mean, causing so much destruction in this person's life.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the things that people don't understand and why we do still victim blame, particularly in churches, right? Because people will say, well, why didn't somebody get out? It's the same questions around domestic violence. Why don't you leave? Why didn't they realize they were being manipulated? Why didn't it's like, because it didn't happen. They weren't offered a hand and the person said, hi, I'm an abuser. Would you like to be in a relationship with me? Nobody does that. Nobody joins a cult. No one marries an abuser. Nobody falls in love with a manipulator. We fall for the person who is doing good things for us. And then they twist it. And then by the time we're already in there. So like a key part of grooming is isolation.
Yes.
By the time this thing starts to happen, you're already the person I trust the most.
Right.
So where do I go to explain what's happening to me? You. And you're telling me this is fine. Mm-hmm. Especially in clergy, your sexual abuse, you're telling me that this is okay, that this is, I wouldn't be doing it if it wasn't. And I'm your pastor. So it can't be bad because my pastor is a good person who only does good things for me. Therefore, this must be okay. You know, yeah. Nobody starts a kind of like, would you like to be in a damaging relationship? No one says yes to that.
Right. And so there's some elements of grooming. Now, Charlotte, you shared before, you have your own personal experience in this, which might be helpful for us in this regard, in terms of like how this happens, like how this can begin. I think that's really, really super helpful if you don't mind sharing, because I feel like that really is a big, like, how did these people, like, how do you get in this situation? Like, how does this begin? How does this happen?
Yeah. So I was sexually harassed. I never quite know how to explain what happened, but so I'll just tell you the narrative, I guess, and you can decide what it was is easiest. Cause so this is a good example, right? As someone who was definitely a victim of something that was wrong, I still find it hard to say what he did and define it in the terms that other people want. We always expect victims to be clear, but actually I'm still kind of like, do I call it sexual abuse? Do I call it harassment? What do I call it? Because I feel like I have to justify what happened. And I'm 44 and this happened when I was 18. So,
and someone who is very gifted in communication, someone who knows their own mind, has all the qualifications, you know, is an effective communicator. And so I think Charlotte, I'm jumping across.
No, that's fine.
As like one of the most gifted communicators I know in the world, the fact that you struggle to communicate something that is your own personal experience, I think is something we really need to bear in mind when, again, because, well, you know, ooh, that story doesn't add up and all of that's like, because this is what trauma does.
I think
a session on trauma, but this is actually a great note to say that when things do happen to you that are trauma based, your ability to communicate and think clearly and operate proper, like all of those things are put at risk.
Yeah.
And so it's not as easy as just going like, oh yeah, I see it clearly now. Here's what it is. Blah, blah, blah. Now I have met some survivors who do are exceptionally gifted at, but mostly that's in hindsight. It's years later. It's lots of therapy. Yeah. You know, even the fact that you can speak about this is actually a miracle. Mm. And a gift.
Yeah, that's it. I think it is like, if anyone wants to just kind of take the clips of this and use it when they're doing things, I'm quite happy with that. Cause I have a PhD and I'm good at writing and communicating, but this, I find I second guess myself about what words to use in case I'm getting it wrong. I also don't remember the guy's name. So I've just sort of trauma erased it. I could find it out, but I just don't care to. It's 20 years ago. I'm not going to bother, but I don't remember. So I remember exactly who he was and I'd be able to pick him out in a crowd, but my brain has just gone like, let's just not do that. So I was 18. I was working for Youth for Christ in the UK. I'd just gone to my first placement, and I come from a non-Christian background. So I have lots of male friends. That's a perfectly normal thing for me. I didn't really think anything of it to be good friends with somebody who was a male or even who was a bit older. And the curate at the time was 26. And I just was really good friends with him. Like, we had a really fun, kind of engaging relationship. He allowed me to do loads of things. So I was really keen. I really wanted to serve God. I'm a talker and a teacher by just nature. I can't help it. So I was really excited to be allowed to be at the front. Especially because my Christian life up till then, there'd been quite a bit of like, oh, can women speak? This is the height of the 90s debates about women in ministry, right? So he's giving me speaking positions. He's letting me do all of those things. He's encouraging me in who I am. I feel like we have a really good friendship. So yes, he's my boss, but I felt like he's my friend, where there's loads of things that we connect on. This is great. And I'm 18. So So for me, like, I don't really understand what the workplace is. I don't understand. The 90s, we didn't talk about sexual harassment and stuff a lot. This isn't something I was versed in. So for me, from my perspective, I had a perfectly normal friendship with somebody. But he's 26 and he's my boss. Now, by Christmas, the people that I was staying with, my host family, were going away. I had nowhere to stay. And he said, well, just come and stay at my house. Like, we're not really allowed to do that under the rules, stay in people's houses, but you've got nowhere else to be. Fine. We start watching a film. He moves really close next to me on the couch and starts touching my arm. I just froze. Didn't really know at that point in my life how to deal with men being attracted to me, even let alone ones I didn't want to be attracted to me. So he starts touching my arm and I just didn't do anything. So I just carry on watching the film, carry on chatting like nothing's a problem. I then go to bed, and as I'm in the room unpacking, kind of getting ready for bed, he comes in and starts talking to me about my nightwear, what I'm wearing, stands behind me. What I remember is him touching my arms and like rubbing his hands up and down my arms. And I just froze. I gave really curt answers to his questions about what I wore to bed. And that was it. And eventually he left. I shut the door, stayed awake, got on the bus at 6 a.m., the first bus out of there without saying goodbye, went home. Pretended nothing had really happened. Like, I haven't talked to my parents about this. They probably won't listen to this podcast, but I guess I probably should now. Because I didn't know what to do about it. And I just assumed, like many women do, I probably had done something to make him think I liked him. Mm-hmm. So I should just not say anything. But when I got back, he started to ignore me. So obviously, knowing he'd done something wrong, he started to ignore me. He didn't give me any jobs to do. So then it's like, I remember feeling like, well, I've got to make this right somehow. Clearly, I've done something wrong because I'm being punished for this. Eventually, he wrote a report on me because he had to do a quarterly report or whatever. And he wrote a report to my other bosses saying Charlotte is uncooperative. She doesn't want to do any work anymore. She is grumpy. You know, she's unhappy. And I was unhappy. And they thankfully sort of said, like, this isn't okay, because that's not the Charlotte we know. When she's with us, she's Charlotte. She's great. And she's doing things and she's out there. Unfortunately, they had a really bad way of dealing with it, which was to sit me down in a room with him and ask what the problem was. And I told them already that he hit, what I'd said was, oh, he hit on me and I rejected him, because in my head, that was what had happened. Mm-hmm. Because I was made to think that was what had happened. Mm-hmm. But they still made me sit down with this guy who ran the church that I worked for, and I knew this was going to be a problem. And so I don't think I can't remember that meeting very well. I just remember them asking why I was in his house, because that was against the rules. So I shouldn't have been there. So the implication is, mm-hmm, I did something bad by being in his house.
Yeah.
You know? And kind of that, like, that was it. But nobody ever said to me, look, he's your boss and he shouldn't be doing this. And you're 18 and
you're like, he was never disciplined or.
Never disciplined. And I also found out, like, that term, I found out he was, and this is where it comes to kind of patterns and things, he was having a secret relationship with another member of the church, mm-hmm, who he told her not to tell anybody. And this was all secret. She was from, so this was quite a working class part of the town we were in. He's a very well-educated, posh guy. And she obviously didn't fit with what he would want as a partner. But he was having an affair, a relationship with her, telling her to keep it secret, promising her lots of things that she would get, but never making it public. Mm-hmm. And this is where we come to, like, people who are abusers don't abuse once. Mm-hmm. That's why it's not an affair. That's why he's not someone hitting on me. Because if I had said yes.
Yes, which you didn't, also I think there's a couple things. One, that freeze response, which is actually very, very, very normal trauma responses and happens so often when it comes to abuse. And so then oftentimes victims will blame themselves to say like, I should have done something, or I should have, or even people spectating or listening to the story will say, well, why didn't you walk away? Why didn't you slap them? Why didn't you walk out of the house? Cause you're literally your flight, you're like, you're frozen. You can't move. You can't believe this is happening. You're second guessing yourself. Yeah. Plus you trust this guy. You're supposed to be friends with, he's affirming you. He's your leader. Like he knows better than you. Like, you know,
and crucially, I had nowhere else to go. So frequently people do these things, make these first moves at a point where someone is vulnerable in a number of different ways. Yes. They're your lift home.
Yes.
They're your safe person. Where am I going at 18 in the middle of the night?
Yes.
Like now I've got a car. I'll get in the car. I will drive myself home. But I mean, so he waited. Right. This isn't a guy. And again, when we kind of come to like how people start to critique your story, well, somebody could say to me, well, maybe he did fancy you, right? Maybe he was hitting on you. Well, he could have hit on me in the pub in front of everybody.
Yes.
He could have held my hand as we were walking down the street on a Sunday afternoon.
Yes.
He could have invited me for lunch after church. Mm-hmm. There are a million ways to have a valid relationship. I'd say 26 and 18 is a bit of a big gap, but people fall in love. There are many ways to have this relationship in the light.
Yes.
He didn't do that. Mm-hmm. He waited till everyone else had gone home for Christmas and I'm on my own in his house.
Right.
And I'm vulnerable to him because he's my safe person. This is the safe place I'm staying on my own.
Yeah. Later on you find out he's also doing this with somebody else.
With somebody else.
And again, so that's that pattern of grooming, which we just want everyone to understand. Like this person is not like, oh, I'm in love with this 18-year-old and I just can't control myself. This isn't just like a passionate outburst.
No.
This is grooming. This is a pattern of behavior of like, I know how to begin. And even that, you know, could have been the beginning of a really terrible, horrible, toxic. So thank God you got out of there that next day.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is that pattern. And then even the idea that when you mention something, then you're basically punished for being in the wrong place. Which, you know, even in that power dynamic, you're like, what on earth? How could this possibly even be up to you? But it's
like, why were you in this place? Like, why isn't the question, why did he invite me? Again, it's just so like, I have no power here. It's not my house. Like, I'm powerless in this conversation.
Yeah.
And again, when we come to clergy sexual abuse, I trusted him.
Yes.
And this is why it's never about whether I could consent or not to what was happening. Of course, I consented to being in his house. But I trusted him because he was the vicar and my supervisor and my friend. And he made himself someone that I trusted. Mm-hmm. And all of our structures told me I should be able to trust him. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I did trust him. So my position, I've just done exactly what I should be doing. He is the person with all the power, and he's the person breaking the boundaries and breaking the rules and being manipulative and being... and is in the wrong at every stage of this thing. You know, all I have done is trust my pastor. That's all I've done.
And but that's so helpful, Charlotte, because that is literally how grooming looks, feels, begins. Absolutely. That's how it begins. And oftentimes, I'm glad you mentioned that other relationship, because oftentimes secrecy, you know, this idea, I remember talking to one victim who was like constantly being invited to events with this leader and just feeling really, you know, just really super special for being allowed and not thinking anything weird about it. Like just, it was this beautiful invitation. And then somebody called, you know, like his wife called on the phone in the car and he's like, shh, and just like pretended she wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And then that was her first glimpse of like, oh, this isn't, this is secret. Like she wasn't consenting to secret relationship. She thought it was just a nice like mentoring opportunity. And again, this is grooming. This is like, now I've made you culpable, even though you didn't consent to a secret relationship with me. Now you're in one with me.
Yes.
Now we're hiding this from now we're like, you know, so again, you're like trapped. You're like trapping people. You're isolating people. You're inviting them into the secret relationship now. Yeah.
And this is how coercion happens as well, right? We talk about coercion quite often, and this is how coercion happens. So I involve you in a part of my life that makes you feel special, but it also comes with danger.
Yeah.
So now there's a sort of a threat. How will you be seen? How will I be seen? And you don't want me to be seen badly. So just don't tell anyone about this thing, because you don't want, you know, we don't want people, and we don't want other people interfering. They won't understand. Mm-hmm. They won't get what we're doing. There's nothing bad here, but they just won't understand it. And we're so special.
Yeah.
And we're so unique. And that kind of, that thing becomes coercion, because then how do I get out of that? Mm-hmm. How do I extricate myself from that?
Yeah, I'm already, he's made me culpable
without
any of my understanding of consent. So I'm trapped, really. I'm trapped in this secret, weird, distorted thing, because it did feel right. And now all of a sudden I get a glimpse of it being wrong.
Yeah.
And then I think there's this other thing where, and we were talking about this before, is nobody wants to see themselves as a victim.
No.
And particularly abusers are really good at affirmation. So again, like in the last episode, we talked about this, like, she's so much stronger and she's so more courageous than me. And that kind of like idea of like, you're so, you know, gifted and you just need a break. And if only you had, you know, and then, so then when this thing happens, that kind of, you're like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, this just got weird.
Yeah.
I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. And now it's weird. But now you're kind of, you can't be the victim. So now you're thinking, like, even with you, you're sort of going like, I must have done something like this. I must be a part of this equation, because it must be me. Like not thinking this is a perpetrator and I'm a victim. Yeah.
And the first time when we're sat on the couch and he touches my arm, I think, did that happen?
Right.
Did that happen? That can't have happened.
Right.
You know, there's a part of your brain going, that can't have happened, because this isn't that situation. We're not in that situation. So did it happen? So you're second guessing yourself already. You know, victims second guess themselves. They're unsure of themselves. And we have to come down again. We have to mention patriarchy at this point, because the reality is that the messaging that women get frequently throughout their whole lives is that we overreact. We're over emotional. We don't always understand what somebody's doing. We don't understand men. We, you know, like, these are the messages we get. And in a Christian culture, we've been getting those as well.
Oh, and even more, we're a threat to men.
We're a threat.
So the problem is us every single time. Even if he does something wrong, I did something to make him do something wrong.
Definitely been told, you know, and definitely in that year in my ministry training, I had been told that I was the wrong sort of woman, that I was too opinionated, that I was too loud, that I dressed too, you know, I'm, for people just listening to this, I'm quite an alternative looking person. So she says, with green hair and a facial piercing, that I looked wrong, that I dressed wrong. Like, you know, like I've already been second guessing my identity as a young woman in ministry. Like, I have been in a position where I've been told, and probably thinking back, I was probably told by him at certain times what sort of things I should be wearing and what I shouldn't. And, you know, like, what, how you do these things to be a trustworthy, good woman.
Right.
Because we really fall foul of the good and bad woman problem.
Yes.
And if you're not fully known as like one, so then have I done something? What am I wearing? Was this top too tight? Was my jumper too tight? Was
right.
Like, I've been given those. So we've also, I think we have to take account when we're thinking about churches and clergy sexual abuse, that clergy, particularly male clergy who abuse women, play on all of those theologies that we have casually thought, well, we in our church don't believe that. And this is where it's important with progressive pastors, because they don't talk like those men, but they know how to play on those insecurities of the women they abuse. So
I would say they almost upside down. So they almost overemphasize their empowering and how amazing and how strong and like capable of leadership you are, in order to create this, like, you know, gratuitous sort of situation.
Right.
Yeah.
He's seen me as the real person. He's seen past the woman. He's seeing me as an equal. And he says the right feminist things, and he's got the, you know, like, and he's not a top down pastor with a hierarchy. Like, He's right. saying these things, but at the same time, I would assume in a lot of these situations, they are being coerced by, I'm the only person who sees you for who you are.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that because I'm the only person who knows you.
So yeah, that isolation piece is so it's you and me, like we're in this and more that becomes the case, which actually a lot of grooming also patterns in grooming. So if you're listening, part of what we want you to learn from in this podcast is what grooming feels, looks, sounds like. One of the aspects that happens in grooming, oftentimes survivors have said, is the person takes an extraordinary interest in you, including like details about your sexual history or about your relationship history. So what actually is happening is almost like a scan for vulnerabilities. That's what's actually happening, is looking for, you know, patterns and looking for vulnerabilities. Whenever you hear of a pastor, a male pastor counseling a vulnerable young woman, that's like literally just a red flag of like abuse happening here. I think, but particularly alone, I would just say, I mean, James, you're a single male pastor. I don't know. How do you deal with vulnerable women who need counseling? What's your go-to?
Yeah. I want to say I have a girlfriend, not to brag too hard or anything. I think that kind of, it is being aware. I think also consistency. I really think that's really key. And so when I meet with someone, when I meet them on my office, I will make sure there's someone in the building. I will always ask them whether they want the door open or closed. It's their decision. Mm-hmm. If you want this door closed, there will be people walking by. When I got my office, there was no window in the door, so people couldn't see. And I'm like, you need to change that. And they did, thankfully. They changed it yesterday. Mm-hmm. Again, like as much transparency and consistency as possible. Would you prefer, again, would you like to meet in a Tim Hortons, a coffee shop here, you know, in a very public place? Would you prefer to meet in the church? There will still be people around. And I think that's part of it too. And again, also recognizing there are certain conversations I'm like, this is not a conversation for me. Again, it's a true, I consider it a real privilege when people are able to share. And I think that's something, again, that's the kind of grievous about this too, that especially because Christianity has distorted sexual sin in such a bizarre way, that my hopefully, ideally, non-judgmental approach is very helpful and healing for some people. I'd hope so. But I'd also say, this is certainly a conversation that I think you need to be thinking about having with other people as well. Maybe you don't want to have this conversation here, but this is also still a very heteronormative conversation. So what do I do if a gay man comes to me and wants to share these things? Now, do I now need to set him up with a woman? I don't really have an answer for this, but I think we need to just be so intentional about it, I think. And again, I want us to be able to be open and vulnerable and know that, you know, there are areas of shame that I want the Christ to like burn out. And I believe that he does, but it's also recognizing even the position that I have too. Like, of course I want people to be able to trust me. And again, if I'm doing my job well, I would be someone they come to. I would be someone they could be vulnerable with. I would be all of those things.
Yeah.
But again, making sure like it is not just me. So there are women in our congregation, brilliant, lovely. But I'll often set them up with, say, some of our elders who are women, and just say, I think there are certain conversations that will be really helpful for you to have with them. Mm-hmm. And again, and if there's even in that situation, if you want to have a conversation with me and someone else present, someone else that you trust, I think, again, continuing to try and be consistent and open so that people can say, look, this is just how James is with everyone, right? Like, this is how he is. So
I think this is the thing. Like, I don't see there's anything wrong with normalizing codes of conduct that keep everybody safe. And the pushback is always this kind of like, well, what if somebody really needs to tell you something and they really need it to be private and they really, it's like, well, as people who care for the wholeness of a person and not just the momentary crisis they're in, we as a church counsel in this way with these things in place, and that is for your safety and mine. And that is part of our duty of care. Safeguarding for me is about going, we care for people more than the secular world would, not less. And it's not about me as a pastor and my amazing ability to heal someone. If God wants to bring that healing, and if counseling is done well, it will happen if there are three of us in the room as much as if there were just one or two of us in the room. Yeah. Okay. Like, let's trust God to be bigger than what we think of our own skills in being great pastors. Mm-hmm. And also just, there are, the other thing we can do is make our congregations, I think this is why it's important to have a podcast like this, talking about what does grooming look like? Because for me, I'm going, if you are a person and you're in a situation and your pastor says to you, you're so special, no one else understands you but me. If he says to you, can we keep this secret, or let's meet in the evening, or let's meet in a dark, you know, an isolated place. If your pastor always wants to meet you in those ways, run.
And run to another one right away. Run and tell somebody right away. That's right.
And so that's the two flip sides, isn't it? There's what our responsibility as church leaders and how we can do our pastoral practice. Mm-hmm. And then there's, we need churches to be places where we're open about what abuse looks like so that abusers just can't use it against people. Mm-hmm. You know, if an abusive pastor comes into your church and the first thing they see is that actually you've got this amazing safeguarding policy that tells everyone the signs to look out for, they're going to go, well, I won't try that here. These people know.
Yeah, and that's actually
cultures of safeguarding. Yeah.
And Charlotte, that's one of the things that's been really driving me lately is way back, I was like, you know what? Our churches need to be safe for victims, you know, survivors. And I felt like God say, no. No, our churches need to be unsafe for perpetrators.
That's right.
That's what we're aiming for here. Like, yeah. And that's the problem is we've sort of been like, oh, we've been focusing on like, how do we listen well? How do we receive? How do we, and actually the question needs to be, how do we make this so clear to potential abusers and perpetrators that not only will you not be safe here, you're going to be exposed here, you're going to be identified here, and then you're going to be like kicked out of here because we have a zero tolerance for abuse and abusive cultures in this church. Yeah. And so I think that's where this, like, I literally think these are the signs of grooming, like this isolation, this like your spouse. Special, but don't tell anybody we have this relationship. This segregation, this isolation, this emotional manipulation, this spiritual spiritualization of harmful behavior. So whatever harmful effects it takes, often this is what makes clergy sexual abuse so destructive, is because it's all the things, including spiritual. So I remember one victim saying, like, I can't read the Bible now.
No.
That's one of the effects of this abuse on my life is whenever I read the Bible, I can hear his voice explaining to me why the Bible is okay with this abuse. And I can't, now the Bible is like dripping with this abusive, and you're just like, oh, like the extent of pain because of this manipulation and this spiritualization. So any kind of hints of that, any control, any sort of offers of help, but with a stick, any threats? So what usually happens is once that relationship turns into this sort of like secret, isolated, and then often the perpetrator will make it sexual then.
Yes.
So there is this, and even with your early, that early, so I would say like early grooming, sexual harassment of you as an 18-year-old, he's looking for a response. If that response had have come, you know, that relationship would have twisted more and more and more, and more harm would have been done.
Yeah.
And part of that twisting then becomes threatening. So this is where groomers, this relationship, this sexual abuse has begun. And often what it's accompanied by are threats of harm. So maybe not to the person themselves, but because they've now made that person complicit, what they'll do is say, think of what would happen if this came out.
Yeah.
Like, think of the harm that you would do to the church. Think of the harm you would do to the ministry. We're going to talk to some survivors who are going to share about how that manipulation was key for their compliance for a longer time than they should have complied because of this threat of harm. Think about what this would do to my family. It'll ruin it. I'm often threats of suicide. I'll take my life if this comes out because it'll be the end of me.
And those are very similar to, again, you know, if people want things through, they're very similar to what happens in domestic violence, right? So we love bomb you, but then you're so much better than me. I'm so awful, but I don't want anyone to know. I couldn't cope without you. So please don't stop. So when, particularly when someone feels that this relationship shouldn't go on, you then get a someone, particularly in clergy sexual abuse, like you say, we've heard this a lot of going, but I can't carry on without you. I can't do this without you. You're the only person that understands me. imagine if I, I'll expose everything. It'll cross the, and they escalate. So they go from just the threat of, I can't do this without you, to these grander things. But either way, then suddenly the victim is responsible again.
Yes.
And the victim feels responsible again for being in it for so long.
Yes.
You know,
and also no one will believe you.
No one will
believe you. Like literally it gets really threatening.
Yeah.
Oftentimes when because they're abusive in nature, they erode. Like abuse doesn't lessen.
No.
Abuse only worsens. It is oppression, and oppression only tightens its grip. Yeah. It never loosens its grip. And the more that you give into oppression, the tighter it gets.
Yeah.
And that's often this journey in these abusive relationships where it gets so unsustainable. I remember Brexy's victim that I journeyed with, I think even recently she said in an interview, even the online visceral harm, like even the threats of violence to me through the online platforms were not as bad as how bad it was when I was in the grip of this abuse. Mm. It was so bad. Like I didn't want to live. Like I could hardly wake up in the day. Like I was so trapped in this oppressive grip that even coming out and all that I faced is not as bad as what it was then. And you know, that's one of the pieces. I don't think we fully understand just how, soul destroying and life destroying that abusive cycle is.
Yeah. And I think let's open it out to kind of institutions can be groomed as well and go back to there. Like a pastor who has made themselves the key to the ministry.
Yeah.
That's the beginning of grooming for me. Like, I'm not saying all of those pastors who've ever done that are abusers, but it's a really good inroad for someone, because now we don't want to fire that guy completely, because what are we saying about what Jesus did through him? Mm-hmm. So we get all of this well, we've got to be able to forgive them and we've got to be able to bring them back in somehow. And you're not allowed to say that they were really dreadful, because that undermines what Jesus was doing. Like the link of the pastor and Jesus is really terrifying. Mm-hmm. And you see it in Catholic church reports. And obviously the priesthood is a particular thing, but in our churches, it's but there's an ability to groom the institution there, because yes, there's this one victim of this awful thing I did, but look at all the countless other things I did that are great.
Right.
One bad sin doesn't outweigh all the good.
Right.
You know, and then bringing it down to numbers and all of that is part of the grooming of the institution that's happened. You know, we see most of these men have had ministries, or I would say the church that I was in, even down to the smallest thing. This guy is the cool guy. He's the cool young curate. Now, he didn't have the power of someone like Brooksy, but he's got that. He's setting himself up as the cool guy who.
And he becomes irreplaceable, which is part of that abusive cycle in the abuse with the vulnerable person, is they become the irreplaceable person in your life. You can't do without them. So I think whenever you get that sense of a pastor, a clergy who's like, you can't do without me. Like I'm irreplaceable here. Without me, none of this works. That is literally the setup of an abusive relationship.
Absolutely.
As soon as you're irreplaceable, you're not leading well.
And it's coercion, right? Like it's all these parts of coercion of being tricked, being worn down, being promised things. You know, this person probably promised the church and the individual person they're abusing lots of stuff. So this promise of don't disrupt this, because what's coming is so good.
Oh yeah. Oh, you know? And that's a case in many. I remember that's one of Bill Hybels' victims who said, you know, his vision was that I would lead with him eventually the church. Like he was going to leave his wife and we were going to get married and then we would be the leaders of just that whole idea of she was like, no, thanks. But even that idea of let me promise you something that no one else could ever give you. Let me see in you. I affirm you. You own. And then all of a sudden I isolate you. Now I make this sexual. Now this is so distortive and abusive. Yeah. And the same thing is done on a big macro level.
Yeah. And it really damages. And we can see, can't we? Like the fallout is church-wide when this stuff happens. And, And it's really difficult because we can't believe that we are the sorts of people who would be fooled, that would be groomed, that would be victimized. We don't like that. We like to think of ourselves as strong people who can discern what is good in the eyes of God. And it's really hard to get our heads around the fact that we were duped in that way.
Yes.
But I think it's important, again, to go to recognize, and like anyone who works in domestic violence will say this, you know, like people who pick their victims, including, say, church, like a whole institution, they pick people who think they are good critical thinkers. Mm-hmm. I've been watching lots of stuff on cults recently and reading stuff on cults. But again, same thing. Cults don't go for people who think and know they're vulnerable. They go for people who think they are good critical thinkers, because that's how you go, well, we all know something the outsiders don't know.
Right.
We've got your special knowledge.
We're special.
Right. We're special. We're inside. Like, right. So we're in this church and we are the people who have the real good truth of Jesus. Like, ours is better than those people outside. So aren't we special? Don't we know special things?
Yes.
And that's all part of this. And again, like, hopefully most of us have moved past that sort of theology where we think that the world can offer nothing and we have special knowledge. But it is a refrain we hear a lot.
Well, and it's even a practice. So even if it isn't a refrain, it's a practice. So like, there's so many people within certain, denominations or churches who don't even listen to anything outside, like who don't have any other framework except this framework. So when it comes to, I mean, I think, you know, in large part, some of what I was able to do and see is in part because I was distant from.
I don't think
if I had had the distance from, I would have been able to see as clearly as I saw, and maybe even some of my background, my experience. But if I was all the way in the way that all the other people are all the way in, and this is like your whole world, then it's very difficult. And again, this is part of how you're groomed. This is part of grooming. You're isolated, you're special, and you're like in this relationship, and there's no other, you're not telling anybody else and you're not hearing from anybody else about it.
Part of that is, that call is to humility, right? Humility. And so maybe I am wrong, and maybe, you know, people are complex as well. And you won't hear many apologies for abusers on this, but people are complex and there's lots to them. Yeah. And absolutely, abusers will have done wonderful things in their lives. Absolutely. Of course they will. And so it's okay to have the humility to say, you know what, I was wrong about that person. Again, and Danielle, as someone who's worked very closely with exploited women for, you know, a couple of decades now, the fact that even you will still miss it. Like the fact that you can miss it
large.
Yeah, exactly. Like, can be close to it and
totally
miss it. I think that's a kind of a call to all of us to be humble and say, you know what? And again, I don't want to assume the worst of people all the time. That's exhausting. But I think it's okay to look for patterns and also just say, like, why are we doing things that are transparently unhealthy? Let's start there.
I would also say that because I understood grooming, like because I know what that is and I've heard it 100 times plus, when I heard what had happened, I instantly recognized it for what it was. This is part of the hope of this podcast. Absolutely. And more and more, and this is why it's so powerful for survivors to tell their story, which again, we're just going to say, like, go check out Hagar's voice, because the more stories you hear, even from totally different contexts, the more familiar patterns you'll recognize.
Yeah.
There is a systemic grooming that happens, whether or not, I don't know, do abusers take a course somewhere secret on the internet on like how to abuse people?
It feels like it at times.
It does feel, I'm like, do these guys like, but like things like encrypted apps and like secrecy and like code words and like, you know, you and me and like promises and like all of these things are signs to look for. And if any of these signs are happening, whether or not you thought better or not, like, you know, you were duped into believing this person was the amazing person. And then you see these signs happening. If you see them happening with someone else, please say something. Interrupt the grooming process. Like, would that every 18-year-old girl who is being groomed would flee that situation as fast as possible and then say something about it. Like, I mean, we can stop this together with enough education and enough foresight and enough fortitude to say, hey, this doesn't look healthy. This is not healthy. And I don't care if even you say this is healthy, this is not. And here are the changes that we need to make this healthier.
Yeah. Cause in some ways, like intent doesn't matter. Right? Like, I hate to say it like that, but if your intent is good, and I say to you, thing is, James, I know that you're meeting with this person. And quite frankly, from where I look, it just looks wrong. Mm-hmm. If your intent is good, you will go, huh, crap. Yeah. I need to change my behavior. That's what good people do.
Yeah.
That's what we need. Like, we need to hold ourselves to account of like, that's it.
Yeah.
To later on go, my intentions were always good. My intentions were good. I never meant this thing. It's like, well, we need better practice for when our intentions are cloudy and we don't know what we're doing. Right. We need better rules because they stop us. But like, the fact that you intended to always do something good as clergy and then you ended up hurting somebody, like, well, we should have had better practice in place. We know enough
now. There's still the harm. Like, it doesn't really matter whether or not you were intentionally running over someone on the road or unintentionally, the person's still now injured or dead or whatever. And you're still culpable for that.
And that happened because you didn't.
Yeah. At this stage in the game, if you're ignorant, if you're like claiming, oh, I'm ignorant, then you're just literally willfully blind.
Yeah.
Because there's enough exposure now that we all need to get a lot more educated in what we're doing and be open to changing our practices.
Yeah. I think that's what I meant. It's not like that your intents don't matter at all, but like we know enough now and we can train our pastors. If you're training people now on pastoral practice, you should be training them. Not just how to recognize abuse, but how to avoid being abusive themselves by accident. You should be training them on good behavior. I mean, I did this training when I was in like in my early 20s. Like, again, I'm 25 years into this and I can't believe it's like, but I was Curly's mentor, right? So we should put all these things on the table.
I'm Curly, by the way. Sorry, that's
you. Sorry, James. You see, I'm tired and I've slipped back into...
I think you might henceforth be called Curly.
I'm good with it. I love
so that. Sorry, James. So I was James's mentor. And we were chatting yesterday about like, well, how did we do this and do it well? Like, were our boundaries off? Like, you know, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, I guess, by then. Mm. You know, like, what did we do? And James said, yeah, but the thing is, like, my husband was always involved in the relationship, his parents, like, we, you know, I'd be at their house. Like, everything was out in the light. Everything was in the light. Like, nothing was secret. I never met James secretly. And that wasn't even particularly like intentional. That was just how it was.
Yeah. Cause you weren't trying to hide anything.
There was no point where my husband would say to me, like, where were you? And I'd be like, oh, I'm not going to tell you, you know, like people were around and everything was in the light. And therefore this was a healthy.
Yeah. I have a mentoring relationship. I have a friend who just like all the codes of all his social media are open for anybody to see, like he's, and I would say when somebody did ask me, like, what's the singular thing I could do to not be somebody who moves towards abusive practices? And I say transparency. Every single time, transparency is the number one thing that you could do. It's not the only thing, there's more things, but that is like the number one thing. If you're hiding, if you're living secretly, if you're doing things, you know, and then that's a good sign you're moving in a wrong direction.
Yeah. And your churches should know, and your church elders should be checking. Yes. And I think, again, I want to get to a point where it is normal for us to check, even with the best of people, to just check that they are doing things correctly and have codes of conduct that your congregation know. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it openly. What's like, you shouldn't be seeing Pastor whatever going secretly to lunch at the end of a service with someone. You shouldn't, if you see them out, you should be able to go up and be like, hey, what's this going on? Like, Let's be honest and open. Let's everybody talk about it. So my church, we're trying to, but legally in this country, so I'm in the UK, legally, anyone employed by the church and anybody who is a trustee has to do safeguarding training to level 3.
What a good idea.
Great. But we have decided that because we want to have a culture of safeguarding, we're going to train everybody. Now, I'm lucky because my church is about 35 people, so that's slightly easier. But we're going to train everybody.
Yes.
Because everybody has a responsibility for everybody else's safeguarding. And then someone asked me, well, what if somebody doesn't want to do the training? And my response was, and I will stand by this all the time, if you want to be in a church community where we say we care for the wholeness and the holiness of people, and you don't want to do safeguarding training, that is red flag number one, and I'd like you to leave.
Right. That's great, because I was also not thinking,
want to not know only, how to care for people.
Yeah, but also not only is that incredible training for the church, but think about the training it is for Christians in the world. Like, this is actually equipping you to be like Jesus in other spaces too, in your relationships, in your, I mean, why wouldn't you want to do this? This would just be like, you're right. That's a good red flag. The fact that you don't even want to be a safe person is a good flag for like, well, I guess you're not a safe person.
Then. Church, yeah.
That's share a meal with one another. No, I hate people. Like, kind of not on brand,
online
actually.
Services are available for you. Yeah, that's exactly.
You hate people. That's right. I have some options. Right.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. I'm really hoping some of this grooming stuff will be helpful to people. And again, if you're a survivor, there's lots of, in our show notes, we're going to have resources. Yeah. We're going to have some people from survivor-led ministries where they are offering help. If you want to share your story and you want us to mention that and maybe read a statement from you, we're welcome to do that as well.
Yeah.
Or even if you wanted to be potentially featured on Hagar's Voice and let your story speak, that's also an option for you. We're so glad you're hanging in there, guys. We think the future of the church is bright. After all we've been through, we, all three of us are deeply committed to the local church.
Yeah.
And all three of us are leading in ways that we hope are moving towards health and safety and goodness and flourishing and shalom for the world. So this is not a, you know, we are not against the church. We are for the church. And it is time for the church to be safe for survivors and unsafe for perpetrators. That's what we're aiming for. So appreciate you tuning in. God bless you guys.